Yeah.
Getting back to Wonkhead for a second, you know, that New York Times story, the magazine story called it, described the persona as a foul-mouthed, hard-drinking, sex-obsessed politics junkie. And you just called it, you just said it was a slutty housewife kind of thing. I mean, I like the idea of this persona that you have built. And then when you go to Time or when you go to GQ or whatever, or now, is that something that follows you or that you have to maintain to some extent? Or you have like even on Twitter because people know you as that sort of persona?
Yeah, and I guess this is, you know, it's an interesting thing to talk about. It is true. I don't know if it's interesting to talk about. Because it is a persona. It wasn't me. And I would like to think that I worked pretty hard to have that just be a part of who I was, who I am, and have worked, you know, in my professional life since then to, you know, to cover stuff that's important to me. And, you know, like gay rights is really important to me. And that's actually one of the reasons why the sex jokes started. Like, they were actually kind of a reaction. I was, as you recall, in 2004, gay marriage on the ballot was a big get-out-the-vote trick for the Republicans. So it was a big issue. And my belief then and belief now is still that one of the reasons is that guys have trouble with guys having sex with guys, you know, and that if it was girls, if only women were gay, I think there'd be no problem with anyone. So, it would not be the political hot button issue that it is. And so that's sort of how the sex joke started, was just talking really bluntly about that. Because also the other thing is, like, when we talk about gay marriage, like, for some people that immediately leads to thinking about gay sex. Like, it's just, that is what where their head goes to. They don't think about the commitment between two people that you might think about when you talk about, oh, so-and-so are getting married. You know, this man and woman are getting married. You're talking about gay marriage, people are like, oh my God, you know. So anyway, so that's why the sex jokes kind of started. And they're funny, and Washington's uptight, and I got a kick out of upsetting the sensibilities of the people in Washington. But that is, again, like, just a part of who I am. And I have made conscious decisions in my professional life since then to try not to do the same kind of stuff. You know, I think that what I would always say, what I kind of always argued, that Wonkette was more of a humor and media criticism site than it was a gossip site. And I think that that's still my core brand, as they say. Like, I'm still, I think, pretty funny, you know, even without the persona. That's sort of what I try to do. And then also, you know, like, I care about stuff. That also happened on Wonkette. I mean, some of the work that I was proud of Wonkette, like, happened in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, when I was, like, really mad, you know, like, legitimately furious with the Bush administration. I think that came through. And making jokes about it, but really passionate, you know, about it as well. But anyway, that is that part of my personality that I feel like I want to work with professionally, you know, moving on. And I think that's mostly worked. I think that there are some people, the people that bring up Wonkette are, I think, almost to a person, people who want to discredit me in some way, or people who want to say that I shouldn't be taken seriously. Which, by the way, I think is not even a good argument. Like, I don't think the stuff I did Wonkette should mean that I shouldn't be taken seriously. Like, I don't think just because someone makes dick jokes, that means they're not a serious person. Like, you know, I mean, The Daily Show will go to the lowest form of humor possible and people still take it seriously as like a source of political, you know, commentary. I think it's actually usually sexism kind of at the core of the people that bring that up.
Yeah, this came out. We're recording this on January 21st, and this came out yesterday, January 19th, from Amy Wallace of the New York Times, writing about life as a female journalist. And the title of the piece is an opinion. It's an op-ed piece in the New York Times, and the title is "Life as a Female Journalist: Hot or Not." And there certainly is an element of sexism that's still there, especially, I guess, if you're talking about an online persona.
Right.
On Twitter, I get some shit thrown at me, but it's fine. It's, you know, there have been the occasional anti-Semitic remark, which is, you know, just rolls kind of right off and you kind of forget about it. But I don't know what kind of, I mean, that sexism, you know, I talked about this a couple weeks ago on the podcast with Claire Smith, who's formerly of the New York Times, formerly of the Hartford Courant in Philadelphia. But she was one of the first, not only one of the first women to be allowed in baseball clubhouses in Major League Baseball, but she was, I think, the first African-American woman to be kind of infiltrate that zone that used to be off limits. So she talked a lot about that, and it was the stories she was telling were pretty crazy. And I asked her, I said, you know, do we get to a point where men and women as journalists are on level playing field? And for the answer, people can go back to that podcast and listen to it. But what do you think? Because there's no way that we're on even playing fields right now, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's funny. Like, what I was going to say is that I have noticed much more, like, you know, I occasionally tweet about sports. And I'm not a nerd about sports. I've come late to that, you know, as something that I'm interested in. And it's responses, that's what actually I've noticed the most kind of like mansplaining, you know, to me. But I also wonder if that's just, I notice it then and I don't notice it because it's just part of the, you know, it's just in the water in politics. And also I think that guys in general, like if you're a professional, you know, male, you know, pundit or journalist, you've learned the rules of like how you talk about this stuff. Like there's not a lot of overt mansplaining, you know, like it's a very politically correct field. And so there's not a lot of overt racism and there's not a lot of overt sexism. I mean, it exists, but it's pretty deeply ingrained and hard to it's hard to get it to the surface. I feel like it's definitely been a part of my experience in mostly the sense that it's just you're usually one of the few women in any given situation. And I think men, I'm not sure if a man will ever understand like how bad that can feel. But that is like almost the right word. It's unsettling. That's it. That's maybe the right word. To be so aware of your difference, you know, like I think probably African Americans know this feeling, you know, because the guys in the room don't notice it. The guys don't think, because they're not actually probably actively thinking, oh, over there, woman, you know, like radar alert, you know. But that's because they have the privilege of not needing to notice that.
Yeah.
Where the woman, I guarantee you, most women, I'm sure this is true in sports coverage as well, I always know like pretty much how many women there are in any given like situation where I'm at as far as in professionally. Like if it's a small room, I'll know exactly how many, you know. Mm-hmm. If it's not a small room, if it's a convention or something, I'll still be very aware, you know. And I think that's true for most women. And the other place that it really comes to the forefront is in how seriously people take you, like going back to that. Like there is a, you know, higher bar, to be taken seriously. And I also think ironically, there is a tendency to feature attractive journalists on television, whether or not they should be taken seriously, you know, like not to say that any of them, that there are women that succeed only because of their looks, but, I do think that
there are women who perhaps should have more success than they do, you know, because they can't get that one, that door is not as open to them as it is to other women.
Yeah,
that's pretty blunt. I mean, but that's not like a shocking thing to say, right? I mean,
no, the most liberal of us sports writers still fall into that trap of being demeaning at times, or
it's a privilege thing. It's a thing, like, it's in, like I said, it's in the water. You're soaking in it. Like, you, it's privilege is something that you only notice when it's taken away, you know. So it's very hard to get rid. It's very hard for people to kind of, even if they want to shed the biases that come with it. You know, like, you're just never going to know what it feels like,
right,
you know, to be the person in the room that's different. Like,
the only times I've felt that were when I was, you know, covering a high school basketball game or covering some kind of summer league basketball tournament. And this happened a couple of times when I worked in Augusta, Georgia, and when I worked in Cincinnati. And most of these events, or some of the events, took place in the inner city. And you'd go in, mm-hmm. I'd go in, and I would literally be the only white guy in the gym, and there'd be 400, you know, African Americans watching these guys play basketball. I'm the only white guy there, and nobody ever said anything. I was never felt unwelcome. But you're right, unsettled is probably the exact right word.
And you're just aware of, maybe I shouldn't say you'll never, but it is something that you only experience in cases like that. And I think it's more rare for a man to experience it. And I think also you probably have to be, that's, maybe even the most obtuse guy would get it in that situation.
Mr. Obtuse here, I got it.
But yeah, I mean, I think that's a good example. It's not that you're threatened exactly, you know, it's just you're very aware that you're different and that these other people have connections and have an understanding about each other that you don't have access to, you know, like, just the way that, I mean, it can be as simple as, like, the way guys can joke around with each other, you know, like, that's maybe not quite the right thing, but, you know, like, and also, you know, guys don't walk through the world thinking, did I get this job because I'm pretty, you know,
instead it's like, oh, she got that job because she's pretty.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
You know, that's the other side of it.
Right. And but a guy is never going to worry about that. It's never going to be eating at him, you know? I think that's sort of where it is today. But it's not like the overt stuff.
There was a really good documentary on ESPN that they ran a few months back. It was in what they call the 9 for 9 series, which was basically about Title IX, and about, they had 9 documentaries about women. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, well, I watched 30 for 30, so I might have seen this
right
one.
So it's based off the 30 for 30 stuff, but it was 9 for 9, and it was about women. They had a documentary about Pat Summitt, the former Tennessee women's basketball coach, and one of the ones they had was called Let Them Wear Towels, which is why I wanted to talk to Claire Smith. And it was about the battle that female sports writers in the 70s and 80s had to face, infiltrating is probably not the right word, but getting into clubhouses and locker rooms and that kind of stuff. And it was really, I didn't know any of that stuff. And I'm a pretty good, you know, I know the history of my profession.
Yeah,
and I'm
student.
Passionate.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a student. Yeah. And I didn't know any of that stuff. And it was enlightening. And I was like, you know, how didn't I know any of this stuff?
Yeah. Well, again, like, something, privilege is something you're aware of only if it's taken away. I should actually, I'll note that I'm actually writing about some of this for my next column this week, which is about, you know, this Obama said he thinks that maybe the fact he's black has something to do with his low approval ratings. And I'm going to try to unpack that a little bit, but to make the point that, like, you know, saying that doesn't mean that people are racist. It means that it's sort of like a situation like what we're talking about. There's something so deeply ingrained, you know, about white people are so privileged and have lived with it for so long, they don't notice when it's being used, you know?
Yeah.
And it's tough because I don't know how you get rid of that in a culture, you know? Like, I don't know how you get rid of that habit of thinking.
I don't know.
Because we can't, we can't do, like, what would be great is to have every white guy in America have to go to a basketball game in inner city Atlanta.
Yeah. Right.
You know, like, that would probably work.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think you can change to a degree. Like, I'll give an example. My brother and I, whenever we call each other, whether it was after college or whatever, he'd answer the phone. I'd say, "Hey, fag," you know, and it was, mm-hmm. you know, it was just kind of an insult.
Jokey. You're yeah. just joking.
And,
yeah.
And now, 7 years later, 8 years later, I would never say that kind of thing to him. Because it's, you know, it's this gay slur basically. So I think on some level you can change if you think about it, but
sometimes it's hard to point, but the thing about it, you have to think about it, but it's almost like it only changes if the person who's doing it notices. Because if, like, I try to call, like, if Obama makes this observation about people, about race being a factor in what people think about him, that for a lot of people is going to be like, he's calling me racist, mm-hmm. you know, and that doesn't get us anywhere.
Well,
you know, I mean, but I see what you're saying, and I do think it's true. I think that's the solution moving forward is kind of, I mean, hopefully people just become aware of difference. You know, it is true that on the gay rights front, like, there have been some really dramatic changes in even, like, the past 10 years. So,
well, I think for me, too, a large part of it is when I've had kids, I thought more and more about, I don't know if this is the right way to think, but it's like, I want to be on the right side of history. So that means supporting mm-hmm. a marriage equality, and that means other progressive things. Because I don't, you know, you see those old photos of old
Bull
white
Connor.
Southern people. Yeah, Bull Connor and Bull Connor and those old white Southern people who are protesting interracial marriage or whatever it is. And you look at those photos and you're like, how would their kids feel? How would their grandkids feel about seeing sweet grandma and Nana or who, you know?
Yeah.
And that does play, I think, a little bit of a role in the way I think about things. Well, how do I want my kids to remember me, you know?
Yeah, but I think that's actually one of the things, you know, Minnesota became the first state in American history to reject an anti-gay marriage amendment this past, you know, in 2012. And part of it was just a really good marketing campaign. And one of the aspects of the marketing campaign is, what do you want your kids to think about you?
Hmm.
You know, it was really good. I mean, it was great. Like, I'm very proud of my transplant, you know, transplanted home state. But it was actually, you know, it wasn't even, went up being not even that close. So it's pretty cool. And marriage is, and Ansel Gate, you know, and then as soon as the legislature convened, gay marriage is actually now legal here, period. So,
I've had Chris Cluey on the podcast before.
Oh yeah. He's a character.
Yeah, he's a character, but he was, you know, you have to respect, what he did, you know, I guess if you don't agree with him, you probably don't respect what he did, but what he did was admirable. I think the whole time he was in Minnesota really advocating for marriage equality, I thought was pretty awesome.
I read the day, I read that. And I think it was a pretty honest account. And I don't mean honest about actually what he was saying about other people. I think it was an honest account of what he did and why he did it. And I think he knew what he was risking, you know?
I mean, he was risking the end of his career.
Yeah, and that's what I respect about him, is I don't think he had any, like, I don't think his point of view was, I'm going to say what I'm going to say, and you better keep me employed no matter what I say, you know, because that's, like, you know, people lose jobs, like, because of what they say. That's just the way the world works.
Well,
I do think the issue of, you know, gay people in professional sports, like, that's going to be a topic in the next 5 years, you know, like, that dam is going to burst at some point.
No question. I mean, maybe even the next 2 or 3 years, I think somebody's going to come out of the closet and it's going to be a huge thing. But getting back to what you were saying about Obama, talking about
how race influences people's opinions.
Right. So then immediately Sarah Palin comes out and says, "Hey, Obama, stop playing the race card." Okay. And that's fine. But
You see, white people play the race card every day. That's actually the thing, right? That's what you have to realize, is that when you're white, you hold all the race cards.
When you're a white man? Yeah, for sure.
But, yeah, you've got a full house, man. Like,
but me and you were going back on Twitter yesterday a little bit about divisiveness and about the Richard Sherman situation, where he comes out
after the
NFC title game and lambasts Michael Crabtree, the 49ers receiver. And it's this very huge story that will continue into
It was a shocking moment, especially like if someone was not following the Seahawks closely, right? Like, I mean, I don't know about, I mean, I'm not as familiar with like the sort of ebb and flow of football fandom, but I know, like, for instance, like the college basketball, people ignore it until March, right? So I'm imagining that there were a bunch of people who saw, you know, Richard Sherman, who didn't really know who he was.
Yeah, though he's probably the best cornerback in the game right now. He wasn't lying when he said
that. He is, I believe, the best quarterback. But still, like, you probably, unless you're following things real closely, like, you probably don't really have a good idea of what his personality is. You just know, oh yeah, he's a really great cornerback for, you know, the Seahawks. And so it was a really, like, it was a shocking moment.
You're right. It was divisive, and immediately on Twitter, I loved it personally. I know a lot of sports writers hated it because they thought it was classless and all that stuff. But then you come on Twitter and say, it was funny because I can't remember what the exact tweet, but it was something like, "Man, I can't imagine covering sports with all this divisiveness." And then me and another buddy, Doug Farrar, said, "You cover politics." So, are they similar as far as that is concerned? Like politics?
Yeah, wow. You have to have another half hour because I've been thinking about this so much.
We can make this a two-parter. You know, it's okay.
Yeah. I've only recently really come to be a sports fan. Like, I always kind of followed it, but like, I think probably because politics just consumed my life so much, like, I didn't really have a lot of time for other things. And so, you know, it's been interesting sort of as a relatively newly minted fan to express opinions about it in public. Because I get stuff wrong, you know? I mean, there's true. Like, I didn't know the story about something. And also the other thing about it that's funny is that I started tweeting about sports during March Madness last year, which is an unusual point. It's kind of an unusual moment for sports because it's a very positive moment. You know, like, there are some rivalries and everything, but most of the time people are just like rooting for the underdogs, and like, there's Cinderella stories, and, you know, I mean, it's kind of hard to find like really negative, mean stuff to say. And so I was kind of lucky that was like first time I got exposed to kind of the Twitterverse of sports writers. And then so in this, as the football season has gone on, like, you know, I've said some things that I like. The first thing is I don't like Tom Brady, which I know I'm not alone in that. That game where I'm going to show off my relative lack of knowledge. Where the call that he just walked off the field and said, yelled at the ref. He was like, "What the fuck was that?"
It was they were playing the Panthers. So this is
right.
And
like, there's a blown call. There's like a call that was like, whatever, like in the end zone, like some.
Yeah, what happened was that Brady was throwing to.
He wanted to pass.
He was throwing to Gronkowski. And then Luke Kuechly from the Panthers had basically interfered with him, and
There's no call. Right. Right. And you know, Tom Brady like went up to the ref and was like, "What the fuck was that?" And then stormed off the field
on national TV,
no handshake.
Right. Yeah,
on national TV, and like no handshake, no nothing. Like, clearly, like, to me, like, pouting, you know, like not cool, right? And also, like, this is a bias that I don't know, like, maybe this is just a sign that I didn't play a lot of sports myself, but I've never understood playing the refs kind of thing, like. Like, I don't get why you yell at a ref, because, like, right. The decision has been made, you know? but, you know, and so I said something like, way to get, like, real classy Tom Brady, something like that. And, oh, my God, I have never gotten so much hate Twitter.
Really?
Like, it was amazing. And some of it was, like, kind of And some of it was sexist. You know, some of it was pretty, like, you know, using bad words for women, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just admit, that does not happen to me that much when I write about politics. Like, so it was educational, you know? And I don't know why that happened also. Like, I don't know if maybe one of, like, you guys retweeted me or something. So it got exposed to people who were sports fans and not just my followers, you know?
Right.
But politics is something that intersects with people's lives. People should realize that it intersects with their lives on a daily basis. But usually they only think about it every 4 years. And sports is something that people think about every day, you know, and it is part of their lives and they have such strong attachments to it. And apparently, you know, there are a lot of Patriots fans out there. and so, you know, I didn't just insult Tom Brady. Like that's the other thing, you know, I mean, I didn't just insult Tom Brady. Like I insulted them.
Right.
You know, and that's something also that I don't think happens in politics. Like, I don't think you have to be a really ardent partisan to feel like when someone says something bad about the president, they are attacking you. You know, there are people that feel that way, I'm sure. But I don't feel that way, you know. And I think when it comes to sports, like that visceral identification, you know, is what makes it so divisive.
That's interesting. I never thought about that way.
And I mean, also like the Richard Sherman thing, you know, I will be honest, like I'm someone who thinks about race and class and gender a lot. And even I like didn't really think about it too much before I dashed off some, like, you know, well, actually what I said to begin with, I don't think was wrong, which is that, you know, hey, people weren't talking shit about you before, guy. People are going to talk shit about you now. and I said Dick and not Richard. You know, and then, like, I tried to sort of, one shouldn't try to have a philosophical discussion, but when, even like with the Tom Brady thing, the pushback I got was, you know, a moment of passion and a passionate sport, and you shouldn't be penalized for, like, being passionate. And my argument about that is, like, there's a lot of passion in the world, and we still expect people to behave with some dignity, you know? And, you know, I mean, I guess I also get the sports writer argument, which is the, you know, I would rather have someone interesting than someone, you know, who just says it was a great game and they played well and we played well and God was on our side or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, or I think whatever piety they use. But, you know, I mean, I like it when people are good sports. You know, I don't think that's a big idea. I don't think that's like a racial, and I don't think that's a racial thing. You know, I don't think it's a racial thing to hope that someone who gets paid millions of dollars to perform for you behave in a way that you would want your children to behave. You know,
that goes back to Charles Barkley saying, I'm not a role model.
Right. I mean, I don't think that's, you know, and he's not. Like, I also tweeted, like, if my kids are looking at Richard Sherman for a role model, then I failed. You know, like, mm-hmm. there should be more people in the world besides Richard Sherman that they look to. But then also, so I tweet all this stuff, and it's kind of critical. But then, like, this race stuff starts to come out. And, oh, man, did it get ugly, right? Mm-hmm. Like, really ugly. And it got really ugly right away, you know?
Yeah.
And at the same time, like, what starts to come out is, like, stuff that I didn't know, you know, like, about who he is and what his story is and what his personality is like in a more full picture. And, you know, like, I changed my mind. I was like, you know what? Like, yeah. Like, it was a momentary thing, and actually I don't think he's a classless guy. I think he's probably an okay guy, you know? And actually very interesting. And I've now watched some of the stuff about him, and like how hard he studies is so impressive.
Yeah.
Right? Like how much he is a student of the game. Like I think is just, that gets, you know, the nerd in me to swoon, you know. But that got ugly so quickly, and it was, I do think it, you know, it was because of race. And I don't know, like that also happens in sports in a way that it doesn't happen in politics. You know, people feel okay saying some stuff about sports figures that they do not feel okay about saying about the president, you know, I mean, obviously.
Well, how much, when you've been talking, I've been kind of formulating this opinion. I wonder, and I minor in poli sci, University of Georgia. So, and I follow politics. Throughout the 4-year cycle, I know what's going on, or at least I read a lot. I don't know if I really know what's going on, but but the I don't know. Is there an idea that what Richard Sherman said was true and honest at that moment in his soul?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe when Marco Rubio says something or when John Kerry says something, well, it's not really what he thinks. It's more of a game, and maybe we shouldn't get.
Right.
Do you think maybe it's not as divisive? Or you find it's not as divisive?
Oh, wow. You know what? I hadn't really thought about turning it around like that, and that's such a good point. Because actually what I thought of as you were talking there was how being the media just, you know, swoon for Chris Christie and for John McCain and for... oh God, there's not a lot of them out there, but Terry McAuliffe, I think, probably is a good example as well. Like politicians who go off script and who say things that are controversial and who say things that are, you know, not necessarily politically correct. Like, we love that in politics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, absolutely. Sure. So I guess that's now I really get why people writing, the writers would be like, yes, Richard Sherman, go. You know? And I don't know. I mean, like, I do think, and you also made me think, and maybe this is your sort of actually your point, which is that people in politics do not speak from the heart very much, period.
Right, exactly.
You know, well, they just don't.
I mean, in a way, I don't know if this is insulting.
And when they do, they are criticized, though. I mean, in a way, like, the parallel is exactly right.
Right.
You know?
But it's almost like, I wonder, if you're a reporter covering the White House or the Pentagon or whatever, you know, I don't know if this is going to be insulting, but it's like, well, are you covering in a way professional wrestling, you know, because it's, there are some aspects that are real. A lot of it's real, but a lot of it is a show. And if you understand that as a reporter, do you play into that? I don't know if that's true at all.
The parallels are so good. The parallels are so good. Except I wouldn't say professional wrestling. I would say like another professional sport, like professional basketball, professional football, because I mean, those are shows too, you know, I mean, they're not as much of a show as professional wrestling. Professional wrestling is all fake, right? Like the stakes are fake. There are no stakes really. Right. Like it's all a game. It's all a charade. The battles are fixed and the prizes are kind of joke prizes. Like, you know, whereas, in like football and basketball, from professional sports, college sports for that matter, but professional sports more so, like there's real things at stake, you know, or things that are more real.
Right.
And these battles matter, you know, to the participants, the people who the players. It is not a game. It is not. I'm going to say that it's not a game for them. And I guess that's right. True. Right. It's not a game. Like this is their life. This is. How they're going to feed their kids and, you know, get old. Like, they need to do well. This game, they need to win this game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, but at the same time, you know, they have a brand to manage. They have a manager. They have, you know, a promotional contract. They have interviews they need to do. They need to have come across a certain way. So there is a showbiz side to it. And that's sort of what politics is like as well. Like in the sense that there are real stakes and there are things that these battles matter, and they matter actually even more than sports in the sense that these battles that occur between parties or between people will result in the laws that govern our nation.
Oh yeah. I forgot about that.
Which is even more important than the Super Bowl, believe it or not. You know?
Well, let's not go that far.
But at the same time, like, you know, like you could accuse people of LeBroning, you know, in politics, right? I mean, like, there's the same kind of showmanship in politics. Oh my God, you wounded me. Oh my God, I'm so offended. You know, that would be the LeBron version of politics. And there's also I am the greatest. There's the Muhammad Ali versions of politics too, yeah. right? I mean, there's it's actually a pretty good parallel. And I think what you will find probably, like, I think probably you and I have a lot in common in the way we cover what we cover, you know, more so than maybe people covering a more technological beat. And I don't mean by technology, like tech. I mean, like, people who cover industries,
mm-hmm.
you know? Because there is a side of it that is important and that matters and that is based in some kind of reality, you know,
mm-hmm.
and also, and there's also like human story aspect to it, right? Like there are real lives of these people who like the Richard Sherman coming from Compton, going to Stanford, like that personal story. And then there's the showmanship part of it. And, you know, the challenge to reporters is to figure out which side to cover and how much to cover which side, you know, like you can't just cover either one. Cause if you just cover kind of the inside baseball, literally, that's not so exciting. But if you just cover the showmanship stuff, then, you know, then you're doing a disservice to people who really want to know other stuff. So is that like for me be a good metaphor?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we basically do the same job, me and you.
I actually think so. I mean, in some ways.
In some ways.
I mean, I think that, you know, people care more about what you write.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. And for something that doesn't really matter that much, as opposed to.
Although it's funny because so my boyfriend's Republican, and so when we argue about politics, like he always wants to take it the metaphor to sports. You know, because mm-hmm. that's intelligible for him. Like when I write something nasty about Republicans, he's like, imagine if I wrote something, it will like bad about the Giants, you know, which he would never do because he's a Giants fan. But like, it, I don't know. I think it's funny because actually he can understand the passion about politics more if I put it in context, if it's put in context of sports. Like that is a way to communicate to him how strongly I feel, you know, and then he can communicate to me how strongly he feels about sports sometimes by making a comparison to politics.
That's funny.
I don't know.
Let me, I'll let you go. I want to touch on one more thing. I think I'm gonna have to make this a two-parter because we've gone for a long time and I think it's good stuff.
All right.
I wanted to ask you about Twitter because we touch on it a little bit we touch on it a little bit, but you know, how the hell do you have 1.3 million people following you? That's crazy.
I'm sorry. It's such a boring answer, but I was a very early adopter. And so I got on Twitter in 2007 and I immediately like got it, you know, like it was something I get it. I understand exactly what this is for and how in a way, like how to use it. I think it's because it's so much like blogging. It's basically microblogging, right? Mm-hmm. And so I tweeted a lot from the campaign trail. And I was one of the few journalists out there doing that. And so when Twitter decided to do their suggested follower things, I was a suggested follow. Mm-hmm. So when Twitter kind of blew up, in the early 2008, like I actually was like John Dickerson, who I think might have, maybe does not have as many followers as me, but he might, but he now is at CBS. So he's on TV. So he explains it. But like we were two of the only political journalists. So, and it was, you know, the campaign was starting to heat up. So, you know, we got that attention. So it's not a very, like, I didn't do anything to deserve it.
Well, like, you had the foresight to get on it when you did.
Yeah. Yeah, and I haven't lost a ton of them, so I guess I'm kind of proud of that, you know? Like,
you know, it is...
There hasn't been, like, a massive unfollow.
Right.
So.
It is funny, though, when I tweet something and somebody like you retweets it, or somebody like my colleague Jason Lockhorn-Ford tweets it, or who's got... He's probably got 150,000, I would guess. Let me just see. But he's got 368,000. Jason Lockhorn-Ford, who's the NFL insider for CBS and CBS Sports.com. You should follow him, I guess. But when he retweets something, or when somebody with that kind of following retweet something, the amount of like, you know, boom, 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 retweets, 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 follows, follows. It's unbelievable. And it's like every tweet for you, for Lock on Four, for Adam Schefter of ESPN, it must be like Peter King of the MMQB.com. Yeah. It must be like, I wonder if it's almost not enjoyable, because it's like everything you say is going to be 3,000 retweets and then 100 comments at you. I mean, it seems crazy.
I think you're getting a not like, it's sort of a slanted perspective on it. I mean, I have tweets that no one retweets, you know? I mean, like, I tweet stuff that people find boring all the time.
like cats?
Yeah, the cats. No, I mean, I don't know. Like, sometimes I think I'm said something really insightful and no one responds. So, you know, but what you're seeing is like when you've said something particularly good, that's why I retweeted it, you know, and other people then also respond to it. You know, it's not like you've written something insightful. You know, and Twitter is actually right now like a pretty pure market for ideas. It's interesting that way. Like, the stuff that gets retweeted the most is often the most interesting thing. Yeah. You know, I mean, not necessarily at the very top, like with the celebrities and whatnot. But you know, if I love that the picture from the Obamas. I guess it was election night, was the most retweeted image, you know, in history.
Well
of us as a country. Like
When they were dancing?
No, I think it's just a picture of them like waving or something. Oh, okay. But anyway, like, yay, go America, you know? Like, it's not a picture of Kim Kardashian. I think Twitter, Twitter is not representative, though. Also, you have to remember that. Like, it's not a representative demographic of the rest of the country. But you know, it's an interesting demographic. It's still pretty nerdy, pretty white, pretty liberal. Like, you know, who knows if that'll change? I love Twitter. I hope it doesn't go away. But like, part of me does wonder, like, what exactly? I guess the utility these days. The reason why Twitter might continue to exist is that it does feel a need in terms of like news, breaking news.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't really allowed myself to think, oh yeah, maybe that does have a purpose. It's not just about cats.
It does. No, especially in the sports writer world, when there's breaking news every 10 minutes. I mean, it really, and there are times when big things happen, and it's like you're at a sports bar, just, you know, chatting with your friends. Really.
Yeah. And that's cool. Yeah. And I mean, like the Richard Sherpin thing, like I use TweetDeck, and, I have a dedicated sports vertical. Mm-hmm. And so like when the Richard Sherpin thing happened, like that was really cool. Like to see a fairly select group of knowledgeable voices, you know, weigh in on it. You know, I feel like that I got to see, because I have chosen those people, I've gotten to see what I think are a bunch of smart takes. You know, I mean, this is better than turning on SportsCenter or going to the sports bar, because I've chosen the people that I think I want to hear from, you know. Another argument in favor of Twitter, right? I don't think we need to make Twitter's probably going to be fine, but
I think it's going to be okay. Anna Marie Cox, it's been fantastic. Oh, it's at Anna Marie Cox.
Right.
Now with The Guardian, she's got you could be part of the 1.32 million people who follow her. She does great stuff for The Garden, formerly of Air America. I mean, you probably know her because formerly of, she's Wonkette. So, yeah. Anna, thanks so much for coming on. It's been so much fun following you on Twitter and having these conversations and for you to come on the podcast. It was great. Thanks so much.
Maybe we can do another two hour stretch some other time.
If people could stomach me talking to you for 2 hours, maybe we can.
Yeah.